It is only through a change of consciousness that the world will be transformed. As we bring mind, body, psyche, and spirit into harmony and unity, so also will the world be changed. This is our responsibility as we create and explore new dimensions of being.
Welcome to New Dimensions. My name is Michael Toms, and I'm going to be your host today. We're going to be taking a mythological journey, a journey for our times, with someone who is eminently qualified to take us on that journey, Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell has been interested in mythology since early childhood in New York, when he was very interested in American Indians. He later went to Columbia. He went on to study French and Sanskrit, medieval French, at the Universities of Paris and Munich. He was in California in the 30s, where he met John Steinbeck. He later went on to Sarah Lawrence College, where he is now Professor Emeritus. During the 40s and 50s, he helped Swami Nikalananda to translate the Upanishads and the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. His books include The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Myths to Live By, The Masks of God, The Mythic Image. He edited the portable Jung, and he's done other books as well. He's an amazing individual, and he has a wealth of knowledge about mythology. And we're going to be talking about how the nature of myth is ever present in our lives, and how really mythology shapes our lives. Stay with us as we explore the fascinating and provocative world of Joseph Campbell. Joseph.
Michael, it's a real pleasure to be with you again.
Well, it's great to be with you, too. I think where I'd like to begin, Joseph, is to first dispel the myth about mythology. That somehow we've related to mythology as just fairy tales and being largely untrue, and mythology is so much more than that.
Well, I think the reason for the misunderstanding is that the imagery and tales of mythology are symbolic of spiritual powers within us. And when these are interpreted as referring to historical and natural events, and then science shows that these historical and natural events did not or could not have occurred, then you throw the whole thing out. But mythology really is the language of discourse between our unconscious system, the spiritual life that really shaped our bodies, and the intellect, which is regarding the outer world all the time and thinking in terms of practical facts and so forth. And the intellect has to learn to read these symbolically. Now, in the old traditions, this was generally understood. Such a symbolic theme, for example, is the virgin birth, which occurs throughout the American Indian mythology. I mean, this is what wakened me to the realization that these things had not to do with historical events. The mythic image of the virgin birth refers to the birth of the spiritual life in the human animal. We can live with the same interests as animals, clinging to life, begetting future generations, and winning our place in the world. But then they can open the sense of a dimension of spiritual quest and realization. And then there is the birth, you might say, of the spiritual life. And this is the sense of the virgin birth.
Is mythology just a study of the past, or is it also a study of the present?
Well, insofar as the mythic forms are alive today, it's a study of the present. And this is the sense of the work of Freud and Jung. They found that in the psyche, in the individual dreams, there were mythic motifs, and that those represented the dynamics of the individual life. Somehow they symbolized what the person was really living for, whether his intellect knew it or not. And so we can say that myth lives today in our own spirits, in our own lives, whether we recognize it as such or not. And when one does begin to recognize it as such, then one can turn to the mythic tradition in which one has been brought up, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, or whatnot, and find a effective support there for one's own quests and realizations.
Let's take a typical myth that most people would be familiar with, say the myth of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and the search for the Holy Grail. How would that myth be relatable to present time?
Well, there are about four, I would say, quite distinct versions of the Grail quest. The earliest example we have is Creation of Troyes around 1190, but the one that is most magnificent is that of Wolfram von Eschenbach about 1220 or so. The one that we usually know of in the English language is that of a Cistercian monk, and we don't know what his name was, but that's the story in which Galahad plays the main role. Now, the versions of Creation and Wolfram have a married man as the hero, and he is a virtuous and competent warrior knight, whereas the Cistercian quest, in what's called the Quest of El Saint Graal, gives us a sort of monkish figure, Galahad. For me, the great one is the quest of Percival, and I'll speak of that briefly. The problem of the Grail quest is the revivification, reanimation of what is known as the Wasteland. The Wasteland is a world where people live not out of their own initiative, but doing what they think they're supposed to do. And people have inherited their official roles and positions. They haven't earned them. And this is the situation of the Wasteland. Everybody leading a false life. T.S. Eliot picked that up, you see, in his poem, The Wasteland. And he actually quotes several lines from Wolfram's Parzival. And it's a place where the sense of the vitality of life has gone. People take jobs because they just, you gotta live, that sort of thing. And then they find in midlife that their job doesn't mean a thing. A friend of mine gave me a list of little sayings, how you know you're old, you know, he says, you've got to the top of the ladder and find it's against the wrong wall, that kind of thing, you see. Well, that's because you really weren't doing what your inside told you to do. Now, the hero of the Grail is the one who acts out of his own spontaneous nature. And he comes to the Grail castle, and here is the Grail king, who is maimed and lame, as the whole country is. Why is he maimed and lame? Because he just inherited the job. You see, and I won't go through how it all happened, but the sense of it is that he was not living out of the spontaneity of his own life. The hero comes and lives out of the spontaneity of his own life, but unfortunately, when he was told how to be a knight, he was told, knights do not ask questions. And so when he sees the maimed king, he is moved to ask, what ails you? That is to say, the quality of compassion and sympathy moves him. But he then thinks, oh, but a knight does not ask questions. And so he represses the impulse of his nature, and the quest fails. Then it takes him 5 or 6 more years to get back to the castle, you see. But the spunk and pluck of his hanging on to the quest and the revision of the mistake he made yields the healing of the land. So the sense of the Grail and the sense, I would say, of most myths is the finding of the dynamic source in your life so that the trajectory of the life that you live is something out of your own center and not something put on you by the society. And then there's the problem, of course, of coordinating your well-being and your virtue with the goods and needs of the society But first you must find your trajectory, and then comes the social coordination.
So we could say that in certain parts of American society, we do have a wasteland existing, I mean, by and large in our culture.
Well, I don't know what your impression is, Michael, pardon me, but mine is that I think the majority of my friends are living wasteland lives. And now, since I retired from teaching, you see, you're teaching people who haven't come into the wasteland yet. They're at the point of making the decision whether they're going to follow the way of their own zeal, the star that's dawned for them, or what daddy and mother and the friends want them to do, or what they've got to do to earn money. The adventure's always in the dark forest, and there's something perilous about it. Since retiring, I've been lecturing to adults, for the most part. And those that I've been lecturing to are those that have felt, I need a new start, or I have to find a center in what I am doing that really meets my own life. And my impression is that many, many, many of our friends just are baffled. They're in the wandering the wasteland without any sense of where the water is, the source that makes things green.
Part of it, I'm looking to explore those principles that come forth or apply when one does discover their innermost dreams and does get in touch with what it is we are to do. And it occurs to me as you talk about the dark forest,
yes.
And that one of the principles is that you have to be willing to take risks, that you have to be willing to go past what the normal rules or traditional concepts of the way things are. You have to go beyond that, don't you?
Well, indeed you do, not only for your own life, but because the way life is getting to be is different from the way it was. And the rules of the past are restrictive of life process. And the moment the life process stops, you're on the way to drying up. And the whole sense of myth is finding and having the courage to follow the process and to permit it. It's, in order to have something new, something old has to be broken. And if you're too heavily fixed on the old, you're going to get stuck. That's what hell is. Hell is the place of people who could not yield their ego system to allow the grace of a transpersonal power to move them.
Something beyond our small self.
Right.
So it's like coming in touch with that deeper chord that resonates in the deepest part of life and being willing to let go and allow that process to unfold in ourselves.
And if one understands the spiritual sense of one's religious tradition, it will encourage one to do that and give one clues. But if one interprets it in terms simply of hard fact, you know, it's not going to help you.
Joseph, I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with fairy tales, and we've all learned to grow up with fairy tales. What about present day authors? Are you aware of any literature that has emerged or is emerging over the last several years that really is in touch with mythology and an historical perspective?
Well, Michael, I haven't been reading any of the most recent works. When I was myself shaping my own life views and all, there were a number of authors that meant a great, great deal to me, but I don't know whether they're still in the wind, you know. One, very important, was James Joyce. The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, Ulysses, were two formative books for me. And along with them, saying the same thing in another language, you might say, were the works of Thomas Mann. They meant a great deal to me as well. The Magic Mountain, I must say, was tremendous for me. In the world of poetry, W.B. Yeats, he has the messages, it seems to me. And T.S. Eliot, in a somewhat more stilted way, I feel that he knew about them but didn't feel them quite the way these other men did. Those are the people that really talked to me. Robinson Jeffers here on the West Coast, and Walt Whitman in Long Island. These are people that continually refreshed me. I was in the literature department as I was teaching, so there were a lot of people I had to know about and were supposed to teach. But those that really talked to me, I've more or less named. And then back of those, there were certain philosophers who supported them, so to say. For Joyce, Dante was a terribly important figure, and Aquinas. Those are men who understood symbols, the symbolic sense of the imagery of the Christian tradition. For Thomas Mann, the great people were Goethe, who's just inexhaustible of this stuff, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche. Then I also ran into Spengler, the Decline of the West, and a really great anthropologist, Leo Frobenius. These are the people who meant something to me. Now, since the Second World War, I don't find the momentum of those people being carried on. I think a whole new set of problems have emerged for young people today, and just what they are, I don't know.
What about the fact that we've had a great deal more explorations in the archaeological field and also in the anthropological field, that now we're coming in touch with shamanic traditions and cultures that we really weren't in touch with a few years ago? We're finding buried cities and places that we didn't know about a few years ago. What does that have to do with mythology? Is that expanding our understanding of mythology, or is it just kind of recovering what we already knew?
Well, I might say that keeping up with what is happening in these fields, and this has been a prodigious time. Here is where, for me, the active writing is going on in the present period since the Second World War. This is occupying me entirely. It's tremendous. It is opening up a whole new perspective on the unified history of mankind. And peoples who were outside of our archaeological discovery and work are now coming in. For instance, the Chinese are doing very important archaeological work. The University of Hawaii, working in Thailand, and it's now been followed by the University of Pennsylvania working there, has unearthed a whole new dimension of the history of domestication of animals and plants, which means a transformation of society in the beginning of the Neolithic and the high cultures and all that kind of thing. And what comes out of it is what has been my theme right along, that all the religions and all the great mythologies and all the poetries of the world, when they are out of the great spiritual sources of mankind's greatest thoughts, they're all singing the same song. It's a great polyphonic song. So that no one has a right to say, where is it? Do you get me? I think people ask me frequently, what about the mythology for the world to come? You can't predict what your next mythology is going to be any more than you can predict tonight's dream. You know, it doesn't come from the place that intellectual thinking comes from. It comes from that source of life within which compensates for the limitations of the intellectual life. But I can tell you what it's got to be. In terms of one's social commitment, one of the important things in mythology is to what social group do you belong? The social group now is the globe. No more of this tied-in horizon. And in the old mythologies, love was reserved for the in-group and nasty names for people outside. I mean, this is characteristic of mythologies everywhere. They've all grown up within horizons. Now those horizons are broken. And so what's going to happen? What are we going to do with the aggression? You know? The old saying of love your neighbor, but hate your enemy has to go. And Jesus was the first, as far as I know, who said, I say love your enemy. Well, they're not enemies. They're our brothers now. And what are you going to do with that? The love now has to work really to temper and transform the aggressive hate thing. And that's what has to be taught through the symbols. The symbols are too culture-bound up to the minute, up to now.
It's interesting how we've taken modern technology in the area, say, of war machinery, weapons, and so forth, and we're still kind of relating to these weapons of incredible destruction so that we can, in the same breath, talk about mega deaths as a result of nuclear weapons. And yet we seem to be relating to them in the way we related to the musket and ball and the spear and shield. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Well, the interesting thing and the dreadful thing is that they're going to be used against somebody. Do you see what I mean? And that somebody is, in terms of the required mythology, our brother, not our enemy. And there's a terrific lag in this extensive view of the range of our social unity.
We have been taking we've been choosing too many electives and not really taking the required courses, right?
But it's something worse than that, Michael. I mean, as though people were afraid of the implications, because that's the dark forest thing. They are pulling back, and you have more and more accent on the in-group commitment. I don't care what the in-group is. It may be just your social class, or it may be your nation, or it may be your race, or it may be your religion. But the in-group thing is...
They're back to that ego drive again.
Well, it's almost as though people were accenting it more than ever out of fear of what's being asked of them, because there's no trust in the person on the other side. I wouldn't advise ridiculous trust, you know. Keep your powder dry. But at least the move and the pattern of intention has got to be that of coordination and cooperation. It's got to be. And how the symbols have always given us our in-group against out-group. Just think of the vocabularies of our own religions, you know, the Gentile or the Goyim. Those are derogatory words.
Yes. I'm just thinking of as we're talking about... you mentioned the world religions and so forth, and how we have, and going back to Christianity, and I think of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the scrolls that found at Qumran and so forth. Do you think that's going to change our perception and understanding of Christianity? Do you think that will permeate into the traditional Christian structure of religion?
Well, I think the most important find, the Dead Sea Scroll finds, belong to what I would call the old days. The sons of light against the sons of darkness, and we're the ones that are going to be the glorious ones. That's tied to the historical concept, and the symbols are being read historically. We are the sons of light, and they are the sons of darkness. Whereas in the Nag Hammadi finds, those Coptic papers that were found in, 1948, you know, in the Egyptian desert, and that have all been translated now. In the Gospel of Thomas, for example, in contrast to, let's say, the Dead Sea Scrolls, what you get there is the all-brotherhood thing. You really do. This is a Gnostic tradition. And that wonderful last saying in the Thomas Gospel, when the disciples ask Jesus, when will the kingdom come? Now, the Orthodox tradition is the kingdom is going to come historically. The answer there is the kingdom comes psychologically. The answer that is given is the kingdom will not come by expectation. The kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it. Do you see what I'm saying? There's a change of point of view. It's a change of perspective. It's a change of what you see. You can look at the other person as an it, or you can look at him as your brother or sister, and the whole world changes.
So do you think that these texts will kind of be... I'm just trying to relate again to how so many of this kind of thing gets kind of shunted off into academia or onto the shelf. Do you think it will come into, let's say, Catholicism or Christianity as a structure?
Well, the first reactions have been negative. The pulpit doesn't want this message. It wants it that we have it. There was a fascinating moment in New York City when the Dalai Lama arrived, and the first welcome was at St. Patrick's Cathedral. And there they were. There were the Catholic clergy. There were the Eastern Orthodox clergy. There were rabbis. There were Protestant ministers and so forth. And the whole sense of Buddhism is all the traditions intend the same end, you know, and our ways to it. And the Dalai Lama, seeing this here, made this statement. Oh, by the way, the young man who was doing the translating, he was a professor from the University of Virginia named Thompson, I think. He was simply magnificent, picking this up and in accurate Buddhist terminology, rendering these translations. So the Dalai Lama really made this point. Well, Cardinal Cook had to let his member of the group know that that is not so. We have it. And I've seen it sitting around the table, rabbis, Protestant ministers, Catholics, and so forth, putting on this show of a cord, but each is holding his cards close, and each has the trump.
So that might be called the ecumenical movement. There's really, it's perhaps mythical.
The only way you can go is by yielding the trump. Yes. Well, then a very amusing thing. 2 days later, or three perhaps it was, at St. John's the Divine uptown, there was a meeting for the Dalai Lama of the Buddhist communities in New York, people interested in Buddhism, and there were over 1,000 people in that place. It was a magnificent event. And it was conducted as though we were in the Jokhan Temple in Lhasa in the old days, you know, with the chants and distribution of prasad, buttered tea. Thank God it wasn't yak butter that had been rancid, but it was delicious. And then the Dalai Lama made a statement. He was talking to the Buddhists. He said, keep up your practice. The results do not happen fast. This is not an instant realization. And as you practice, you will become aware of a change of consciousness. Do not become attached to your method. For when your consciousness will have changed, you will recognize that all the methods are intending the one goal. That's the song that mythology sings. It comes from the spirit of the human consciousness, which becomes differently inflected as we go, let's say, from Germany to Japan to France to Iceland, or from the 12th century to the 20th. But those inflections are secondary.
Joseph, you're mentioning the story of the Dalai Lama visiting New York, and just brings to mind the influx of, particularly of Eastern religions into the United States and Western culture. And this started to occur in the 50s with the influx of Zen Buddhism, and then continued with other Eastern traditions coming here in the 60s and 70s. What do you think that presages? What do you think is coming as a result of that?
Well, I think the you must remember that when we're having teachers coming from the East, we're getting the best. There are also crude folk traditions in the East. That's not what we're getting. But the crude folk traditions in the West, that's what we've got. And our best teachers are not the ones that are most listened to. Let's put it that way to start. Now, the best teaching from the East is this one that I've just described of the Dalai Lama. We had it from Sri Ramakrishna. We have it all over the place from the East, namely that there is a common consciousness which is our own ground, and so in consciousness we are one. Insofar as you identify yourself with the consciousness that moves and lives in your body, you've identified with that which you share with me. And on the other hand, if you get a fix on yourself and then your tradition, we've got it, then you've removed yourself from the rest of mankind. Now what the Eastern teachers are telling us is the important thing is not what happened 500, 1,000, 2,000, or 2,500 years ago. Let's say when the Buddha was born and taught, or when Jesus was crucified. What is important is what's happening in you now. And what is important is not your membership in a religious community. What's important is what that membership is doing to your psyche. And it's within you that the divine lives. Our religions, our Western religions, tend to put the divine outside of the earthly world, in God, in heaven. But the whole sense of the Oriental is, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Who's in heaven? God is. Where's God? He's within you. And what is God? God is a personification of that world creative energy and mystery, do you see, which is beyond thinking and beyond naming. We think our God has not only been named and known, but he's given us a whole system of rules. Their view is quite different from that. This system of rules are not from God, they're from man, and they're man's clues to how to get to the realization of God. It's a quite different orientation, and it's one when you hear it, you say, ah, yes. Now, the wasteland might be said to be taking of these things literally, concretely, and the rejuvenation of the Arthurian Grail hero, that of recognizing these as of the dynamic of your own interior. Because we're all from a mysterious trans-rational ground. The subatomic particles tell us that. We don't know what in heaven's name they are, and that's what we are. And then our mind is in this world of time-space relationships, and the mind must open to the impulse and statements of that primary precedent of the general consciousness.
You know, if we look at some of these, you're mentioning the folk traditions, reminded me of in looking at some of these older other cultures that have been around for centuries and early cultures. One of the major differences between some of these ancient cultures and our own is that the people really had a balance between being in touch with their deeper side, their innermost selves, and life on the pragmatic level. And like we can look at the prehistoric caves they found in France and Spain, I believe, with the where they have shamanic drawings on the walls of these caves, and indicating that these people very much had a religious base, had a perception of the spiritual side of life. And somehow in our culture, we have to retreat from life to find it. We have to take a vacation, or we have to go off somewhere, or we have to go where it's not a part of our life. And we see that permeating our entire society, where somehow the spiritual is over here in a compartment, and on Sundays we get in touch with that, and it's not really a part of the rational or the pragmatic side of life. How about that?
Well, in the first place, until the 19th century and the rapid progress of the industrial transformation of the world, the conditions of life lasted a little while. You know, for generations, they were essentially the same. So that the manner of dealing with them and getting the spiritual sense of one's relationship to these activities could be developed and richly experienced. However, even in my lifetime, the conditions of life have changed so rapidly that by the time you get yourself related to one set, another comes along. And I think part of the anxiety of our time is just the result of the rapidity with which change has taken place, and one cannot get a spiritual relationship to this rapidly changing practical problem. That's the how about it of this thing. Now, another important point that the Oriental traditions bring to us is you don't separate your practical life and your religious exercises. Religion isn't for Sunday or for Friday night. You see what I mean? It is for all the life of the whole day. For instance, we're in a religious exercise right now, you and I, Michael. Do you see what I mean? In our relationship, what is it that's playing in? It's through the life that one is to experience the Spirit, communicate the Spirit, and live in it. There's a wonderful little story about Sri Ramakrishna, the great Indian teacher of the Hindu teacher of the last century. A woman came to him and said, Master, I've had to admit to myself that I don't love God. I've tried to, but that's not where my love is. Well, he says, is there nothing in the world that you love? And she said, yes, I love my little nephew. And he said, there he is, in your service to this child. You are in service to the spirit that lives in that child, which is the divine. That's beautiful. And the whole thing of Zen Buddhism, you know, when someone says to the master, what is the Buddha? And he says, have you had your breakfast? Yes. Did you wash the dishes? Yes. All right. Another thing they say is, if you see the Buddha coming down the road, run away. Because if you concretize the divine in any fixed image and say, there it is, you're off.
We're really talking about the great mystery, the ineffable.
That's what we're talking about. Yeah. It's exciting to talk about it.
Yeah. It just occurs to me that so often we relate to these other cultures as, quote, primitive. We have this word, primitive. And we see ourselves as civilized and advanced civilization. And yet we've lost so much of what was present in some of those primitive cultures. Namely, that ritual that existed through life that put people in touch with the ultimate.
Well, the word primitive properly just refers to the complexity of the mechanics by which people live. And they are primitive in that sense. I mean, just compare the way I got here by airplane with the way I would have had to get here in a really primitive time. I'd have had to walk from New York before even the horse was mastered. And that's a condition of very, very primitive people. But when you think of their spiritual life, just read any of the American Indian materials. These people lived in a divinely alive world. A man with the calumet about to smoke would point the stem first to the sun so that the sun could smoke. Then he addresses it to the four directions. And in praise of the divinity that's there, he participates in it himself. The whole life is utterly religious. Crude, as it may be, in contrast to ours in terms of the mechanics of life. But ours, I would say, in terms of the spirituality of life, is the crude, primitive one, because we've lost the way to link it. And yet, it hasn't been lost. We don't listen to the people that are telling us how.
Going back to that brotherhood, idea of brotherhood you were talking about earlier, and I think of the American Indian when they had no concept of owning land. And it took the white man to come in and say, this is my land and it's not your land. And there were so many traditions that we came in and just sort of covered over and just destroyed with our perception of the way things work.
Well, the most vivid contrast comes, and I heard this only last week, actually, this speech that Chief Seattle delivered when the white man wanted to purchase his land. He said, how can you purchase what we don't own? Our brother Eagle, will you take care of him? The water, my father's blood, my father's voice is there. And this land, and that impresses me so. Here are people that had tough lives. I mean, it was real tough, but they loved it. And here we are having it soft, and many of us just think, oh, gee, as James Joyce says, is life worth leaving? We haven't learned to live it. And that's because I think of this it of the mechanical world round about. It's more difficult to think of this microphone before us as a loving thou than it is to think of a tree or a lovely little squirrel. And those people lived in a living world, and we're living in one that it's living on a very deep level. You know, the subatomic particles are there too, but it doesn't look that way.
Yeah.
So we're disengaged.
One of the aspects of mythology that's always been fascinating to me is the vision quest. We can see it in almost every culture. Every tradition has as its base the vision quest. What is the vision quest?
That is the basic myth. It is the quest of anybody. For instance, in this world that we're in now, which seems to be disengaged from vision, is the quest for the visionary relationship to that world. That's they define the spiritual relationship to the world that you're in. As the world changes, the vision quest changes as well. Now, the first visions were those of the shamans in the caves, but their people were just very small groups compared with what is a people now. And when settled tribes, settled peoples began to be important in about the 10th and 9th millenniums B.C., larger communities, the problem of relating to those comes up, and we have more complicated priestly relationships than in the earlier shamanic, and the shaman goes out and the priest comes in who represents the gods of the community. The shaman's deities were his own private familiars whom he discovered in vision. The deities of a larger social group are inherited by the tribe, and the priest is the officer of those deities. He doesn't necessarily experience them as the shaman does. Now that poetic experience is what we've got to have again. It's much easier to have a poetic experience in the beautiful mountains and forests of California than it is to have the poetic experience in the factories, let's say, of Detroit. But that's where it's got to go. And the vision quest to reactivate our world has to deal with our world.
Another aspect of the vision quest is the encounters with demons, and we have a tendency, I think, to push our demons under the rug and hope they'll go away, when in reality we really have to face them.
Our demons are our own limitations that shut us off from the realization of the ubiquity of the spirit. And so as each of these demons is conquered in a vision quest, the consciousness of the quester is enlarged and more of the world is encompassed. I mean, basically, that's what it is. It's getting past one's own limitations. These are within, and they seem to be without. Conflict between two people is the result of their respective limitations with respect to each other and so forth. And these are symbolized in these myths. So that the monsters and demons of mythology are really symbols of limitations within the individual. And in each age, the characteristic limitations change. As a people changes, its limitations change.
Just occurs to me, going back again to the idea of how we really have to, we are a global society now, and the global myth is one that we really have to understand in a much larger way than we have up to now. And I think of that limitation, how we often perceive other cultures as being very different from ours, and how we somehow want to make them like ours, that American democracy, for an example, has to spread to this country and that country, and in some cases, in many cases, the nature of the people and the nature of the situation is so very different that democracy in the form that we understand it could never work, and we have to really not only relate personally, but we have to take that personal understanding of our limitations to a global understanding, don't we?
Yes, I would say that's a major problem. A major problem is seeing in someone who lives a different kind of life than the one that you regard as the proper one, the human being at the same time. This whole thing of conflict and love, you know, where Jesus says, I say love your enemies, he didn't say don't have enemies. You know, and you can become a slob on this thing and say, oh, everybody's just lovable, as though that person were not going to knock you in the eye. the problem of living as an aggressive, vital presence in the world, and at the same time having this universal consciousness is a major one. I've been enormously impressed by, again, the primitive people who had to kill animals to live. But the attitude toward the animal was not of animosity. The attitude was of gratitude to the animal for yielding his body, you know, and playing the universal game where life lives on life. I mean, that's the way we live. We have been removed from this because our butchers do the butchering for us, and then we buy a nice, neat lamb chop, you know.
That's how we can come up with terms like megadeths, because we're so far removed from it.
Depersonalizing the object of being killed. But what is it when you do the killing yourself? These people killed the animals, and we're grateful to them for giving their body. Now, there's a very interesting saying from the Rig Veda. It's in a small verse in the 10th book of the Rig Veda that has been a clue to me for how this thing has to go. And it says, on the tree of our lives, that's your life, my life, or the world's life, there are two birds, fast friends. One eats the fruit of the tree, and the other, not eating, watches. Insofar as we're active in the world, we're the bird that eats the fruit. And what is the bird doing? It's killing the fruit. It's consuming the fruit. And the fruit is yielding to the bird, you know? The other, however, is indifferent to who wins. It's just watching this way of life. Now, in meditation, one can get so far onto the side of the bird that is watching that one can become unfriendly to the act of life. Do you see what I mean? And many people cut themselves off that way. Whereas the proper necessary attitude is to recognize the necessities of life, which have to do with competition, and affirm it, but not in the way of enemies, but in the way of participation in the game of being alive. Now, it's not too easy, but it's got to be done. I think an awful lot of one of the things that discredits the World Brotherhood point of view is the tendency to say, you know, turn the other cheek and let him smack you down. That's depressing of life. That's wasteland stuff again, because life is active, and tensions are the very source of energy. But the attitude toward them is what's important.
What are some of the things that we might be able to do to bring us more in touch with that understanding of what we've been talking about almost the last hour?
Well, since people get their messages from the clergy, they really do. In this country, they do. I've been around now a good deal, and in the cities we may say, well, the source of people's virtue and all is from their intellectual life and their own personal living and thinking and the community of the people they're with. But when you get out of the big cities, we're still in the area where the clergy are the great teachers, and they're the ones. It's up to them. It really is. And this is why the Oriental gurus are having such a success, because the clergy, by and large, are hanging on to old traditions by main force. And they are exclusive traditions. The traditions that say this is the way good people are, that's to say the way we are, and others are different. How difficult it has been to change the ideas toward, let's say, abortion, you know, in the face of rules in the past. The relationship of people to each other is changing and changing, and yet not being recognized.
Joseph, you wrote the definitive book on the hero with a thousand faces. And do you see that we have any heroes in our culture, in our society, in our...
Well, popular heroes are right now, I think, very, very crude. I don't mean to say that the people who are the heroes are crude, but the order of life they represent is crude.
So maybe sports figures or movie figures.
Exactly. Or political figures. These are people playing the obvious game, but the deep spiritual masters and heroes are not the public heroes. I find, however, that in private life, people I talk to, they have heroes that are not those that are in the public media. A great hero is Jesus, for example. A great hero is the Buddha, and these figures are operative in lives, not very much in the popular way, but when you see what people are reading, they start in the back of the paper, it's sports figures. Those are fine, but they represent only one aspect of life, that is that of physical well-being and competence and attention to the game. Then the intellectual or spiritual heroes, we don't hear so much about them. For me personally, when I was growing up, I had sports heroes, but also the heroes of my intellectual life. James Joyce was one, Thomas Mann another, and I think people have those heroes now as well, private to each. It's a world where we have many, many ways of life, and a single overall philosophy or hero giving is not possible anymore.
Joseph, I want to thank you. It's been an extraordinary and enlightening conversation.
Thank you, Michael.
New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio, a nonprofit independent producer. Since 1973, New Dimensions Radio has been dedicated to producing programs about social and personal transformation, about positive choices for the future, and about a world in which people matter. For further information, our address is New Dimensions Radio, Department S, 267 States Street, San Francisco, California, 94114.